Tonight, we're going to be continuing our series on the home, and as we looked last night at the role and responsibilities of the husband, we'll be looking tonight at the roles and responsibility of the wife. And last night in Ephesians 5, we read about that pertain to the husband. We go back to the same passage in Ephesians 5 to look and see what it says for the wife. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22. Wives, be in subjection unto your own husbands, as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, being himself the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives also be to their husbands in everything. As we saw last night when we looked at the 1 Peter 3 passage, I don't believe weaker vessel there was referring to weaker in intellect or even weaker in strength, although the latter is usually true, comparing the man and the woman. But in the context we saw, there were three persons told to be in subjection to somebody else, and the one to be in subjection was the one that was weaker in authority. The citizen is to be in subjection to the governor or king. The citizen is weaker in authority. The servant was to be in subjection to the master. The servant was weaker in authority. The wife is to be in subjection to the husband. The parallel here, drawn to Christ and the church, is interesting. As we saw last night, the husband's responsibility in leadership is to be a sacrificial, serving leadership, as the text said. Husband, love your wife, in verse 25, as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for it. So just as Jesus sacrificed himself for the church, the husband is to sacrifice himself for his wife. He is to provide leadership for her benefit, not simply to take advantage of leadership for his own benefit. Her part is to be in subjection, as the church's responsibility is to be in subjection. And that's not a popular concept today. There's a lot of people that don't like the concept that the husband is the head of the house and that the wife is to be in subjection to him. Lots of girls, when they get married now, they don't want in their wedding vows the old vow to honor and obey. They don't want that there. But God put that principle there. And so the Bible says wives are to be in subjection to their husbands. This brings up a challenging point for both wives and girls who are someday going to be married. First off, to wives, is to be in subjection. If you're anything like my wife, then you know that sometimes your husband does knucklehead things, you know, and makes some stupid decisions or doesn't have the best idea on things. And like I said, I'm thankful she puts up with me. But the responsibility to be in submission is not limited to, well, I'll be in submission as long as he does everything my way. When we're told to obey the government, we're not told to obey the government and pay your taxes as long as you approve of the way they spend it all. If we paid our taxes based only on how we approve of how Washington spends the money, how much taxes do you suppose you and I would be sending in each year? We have a responsibility to be in submission to the government. If we take a job, we have a responsibility to be in submission to that employer. Now, there's an obvious exception to that, right? When the Jewish Senate told Peter and the apostles, you will not talk about Jesus Christ, what did Peter say in Acts chapter 4 and Acts chapter 5? Both times that he said, we have to obey God rather than men. So when the government tells us, you will commit this sin, then no, we won't. When our employer says, you will falsify this report, you know, and lie about it and put this false date on there and submit this fraudulent claim, we need to say, no, I won't. And when a husband tells his wife to commit sin, she needs to say, no, I won't. But other times, what do we need to do? We need to submit. And we'll see a positive effect on that, that it can have even on not the best husbands when we get to 1 Peter 3. But before we leave this, let's talk about why, girls, you should be very careful about who you marry. Because guys should be careful too, but because the woman is going to be the one accepting the role of being in submission, you especially want to be careful about who you choose to be married to. It's going to be easier to submit to someone you respect. Sometimes girls can make terrible choices. I saw a girl recently make a choice, and we all tried to tell her better. I hope the fellow turns out to be worth more than he has so far, but, you know, it's not looking really good. And I'm afraid the day's going to come where she's going to regret her choice. But who made that choice? She did. Who's got a responsibility to live with it? She does. It can be very difficult. A fine Christian woman was talking with me recently, and her husband's not serving the Lord. She is. And it's just difficult. She's got kids, and one is approaching an age where it's going to be easy for him to go one way or the other. He's a boy, and his father's not serving the Lord. His mother is. It's going to be very easy for that boy to do what? And she also described a situation to me that most wives don't have to deal with and put up with. She has to deal with the situation of going to parties with her husband that she would rather not be at. But she knows he's going. And based on his past track record, and he's a better man now than he used to be, but based on his past track record, she knows that he needs him there because he could end up getting himself, you know, in further trouble at some of these parties. And so she goes, and the carrying on that goes on there, she doesn't take the kids there, but she just feels in a real dilemma. She will not let her kids be exposed to that, but she knows her husband's going, and he doesn't, she feels it's good for her to be there to keep an eye on him. And so she ends up not partaking, you know, in the things that go on at the party, but feeling the need to be there. I'll tell you what, that's just sad. She shouldn't have to be put in that situation. Think about what man you are going to marry. Fellas, we're going to talk about this tomorrow too, probably tomorrow night, thinking about what type of girl you want to marry. These are big decisions. These are important decisions. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1 through 6. Wives are told, if you're married to an unbeliever, even if he won't listen to the word, by your behavior, you might be able to win him. Now, nagging is not going to do it. In fact, let me just go ahead and give you a tip. Husbands and children tend to treat nagging a little bit like static on the radio. It's an unpleasant sound you wish would go away, but you don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. That's not an effective thing. Conduct is. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1. In like manner, you wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that even if any obey not the word, they may without the word be gained by the behavior of their wives, beholding your chaste behavior coupled with fear. Whose adorning, let it not be the outward adorning of braiding of the hair and wearing of jewels and of gold and putting on of apparel. Let it be the hidden man of the heart in the incorruptible apparel of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. Unions where there's nothing but physical attraction are probably not going to last very long. and generally don't. There's other people in the world that are physically attractive. And there can be someone that you find yourself physically attracted to, but if you live with them for a month or two or three or four or 5 years, and you become disgusted by their behavior, it's hard to be attracted to somebody that is just gets on your nerves all the time and you can't stand, and you don't have anything in common with, and you don't think alike. The adorning, let it not be putting on all this stuff on the outside, let it be making this person on the inside a meek and quiet spirit, which is inside of God, of great price. A husband can look at his wife's good behavior and be drawn to that. One time, a fellow became a Christian, and after having opposed behavior, his wife's stance somewhat before and giving her a rough time, when he became a Christian, she said, "Why did you give me such a rough time?" He said, "I was jealous. I wanted to be a better person and wasn't. And you were what I wanted to be." Now, of course, she'd never guessed that before. But that's what was going on with him. Example is such an important thing. But what is it to be? It is to be this humble, submissive example of a meek and quiet spirit. "For after this manner aforetime, the holy women also, who hoped in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord." It's referring to back in the Old Testament where speaking to him, she refers to him as her Lord. That's pretty respectful. Now, I don't require Bertina, you know, when I come home, for her to say, you know, "Greetings, my Lord, I'm glad you've returned." She doesn't have to say that. But that's what Sarah said to Abraham, and it's commended here as an example of respect. Contrast that to sometimes how wives speak to their husbands. Bonehead is, you know, far, far on the other end of the spectrum. But not just that, but we're talking about tone. Why? Last night we asked husbands to think about some verses. Does your wife feel honored? Does your wife feel cherished? And they should, because, fellas, what are we told to do? Honor them and cherish them. So now, question tonight for the wives. And again, fellas, no elbows. Does your husband feel respected? Does the way that you speak to your husband make him feel and know that you show him respect? Or does the way that you speak to your husband, or refuse to speak to your husband, or the tone in which you speak to your husband, show something entirely different? The Bible says, let it be the hidden man of the heart, a meek and quiet spirit. Is yours a meek and quiet spirit? Is that the attitude and the respect that you show your husband? Now look at Titus chapter 2, verse 4. Let me make just a side comment here. When we say doctrine, what do we usually think of when we talk about doctrine? If we say, well, that's a matter of doctrine, we usually think of things that relate to either a concept of theology, what we believe about God, or how to respond to God's offer of salvation, or the workings of the collective congregation. The work of the church, the worship of the church, the finances of the church, the teachings of the church. We usually think of those things as doctrine. Other things we think of, these are practical things and moral things. I just want you to notice that in the Bible, this is doctrine too. Doctrine just means teaching. And sometimes people can get the idea that teaching about church funds, plurality of elders, what day to take the Lord's Supper on, those things, that's important doctrine, and other things That's not doctrine. These things are doctrine too. In Titus chapter 3, look and see what it says there. I'm reading from the American Standard Version, and it uses the word doctrine. In fact, it uses the phrase sound doctrine. And it's interesting to see what Paul called sound doctrine. The word doctrine just means teaching. In fact, you may have a more recent translation, and that's just what it says, teaching. Listen to it. Speak thou the things which befit the sound doctrine. What is it? That aged men should be temperate, grave, and sober-minded, sound in the faith, in love and in patience. That aged women, and likewise, should be reverent in demeanor, not slanderers or enslaved to much wine, teachers of what is good. That's sound doctrine. There are some churches that might say that they're practicing sound doctrine, but if their older men aren't reverent, and if the older women are not teachers of what is good, do they have sound doctrine? I'm not saying that the other points aren't important too. I'm just saying that these types of things are very important, and really lots of times the Bible spends more time focusing on some of these. So it's all, both sides of the equation are important. It's both points of doctrine. And when it talks about these older women being teachers of what is good, look who they are to teach. Verse 4. That they, that is the older women, are to train the young women to do what? To love their husbands, to love their children, to be sober-minded, chaste, pure, workers at home, kind, and being in subjection to their own husbands. To train the younger women to love their husbands and love their children. Now, usually when people get married, they say, I'm in love. Jeff, you've probably had some of these situations where a young couple comes to you and you can tell they're not mature enough, but they're just, oh, we're in love. And you say, now, do you understand the seriousness of marriage? Yes, 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 we love each other. We're in love. I remember one of those when 6 months, you know, she was cheating with a college professor and they were divorced. Another one, this couple came, her parents or his parents, one, had been visiting church, and they said, I forget if it was son or daughter, is getting married. I think it was their daughter. And they said, they want to get married. We're not too sure about this, but they're going to get married. Would you marry him? I said, well, I'll talk to him. He was in drug rehab. She had gone up and taken him out of drug rehab before he was done. And they came down and wanted me to marry them. We had a conversation, and they sat there, oh, we're in love. I said, do you understand? Oh, yes, 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 we're in love. Oh, yeah, we'll always be there. I told them I wasn't going to marry him. And then it wasn't, he wasn't even going to be working. I said, where are you going to live? Well, we're going to live in my mom's mobile home. And what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to be working at Taco Bell. What's he going to be doing? Well, you know, he just needs to kind of have some time. You know, he's been on drugs and everything, and just kind of regroup or something. So I opted out of participating in that. A few months later, though, I saw him in town because they were going to be living in Florida. He was in town there in Pennsylvania. I said, hey. And I said, all right. And he said, oh, fine. I said, where's your wife? Oh, she's down in Florida. You know, things are working out. And you never see, they never come to you and say, why do you want to get married? And they say, oh, because we're not in love. They always say, we're in love. They don't always understand what love is. For one thing, lots of times, and I'm getting here into my material for tomorrow night, so I'm going to stop and hold off on that and get back to that tomorrow night. But notice that here it says older women are to train the younger women to love their husbands. Sometimes somebody thinks they're in love, but they still need to be learning about what love is. Well, let me go ahead and make this point. Girls, fellas, And somebody your age is talking about, oh, I'm in love. Lots of times, what's the guy or girl talking about? If you've got a friend and he says, oh, I'm in love, and you say, what do you mean you're in love? What do you love? Oh, I love the way she looks. I love her eyes. I like the way she walks and talks, and I like the way her hair does, and I like the way she laughs. I love the way she makes me feel, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that is about what? What he gets. What does John 3:16 say? God so loved that he gave his only begotten son. Love is about giving. People need to learn, and there's a lot of people that need to be trained and taught how to love their husbands and love their children. To be sober-minded. I was moving a family. They'd moved to the area and they were going to be coming to church and everything. It sounded like a lot of positive things about the family. But I went up to move them and I'm just so disappointed. Picking up boxes just full of these trashy romance novels. You know, the kind that you see if you stop at a yard sale and there's, I don't know why people have no shame. They don't need to be reading that trash in the first place. But then, you know, for all the world to see, here, now I'm selling them this trashy stuff. God means for romance to be enjoyed between the husband and the wife. We talked about the passage last night from Proverbs 5, where the husband is told, rejoice in the wife of your youth. Be exhilarated in her love. There's too many people living in a fantasy world, too many men watching other women, too many men thinking about other women, too many women thinking about, you're reading these trashy novels, or have you heard of these online affairs that are going on, and emotional affairs, where in one definition of the emotional affair is it's an affair that hasn't become sexual yet. But she's found somebody that, oh, he understands me, he listens to me, and such. And there's just, and these people, how many of you, just a show of hands, is somebody you work with or a family member or somebody at your kid's school or something, how many of you have heard of a situation where a woman ups and leaves her family to go off with some man that she met over the internet and they've been flirting with each other for a few months on the internet? How many of you have heard of that happening? A lot of that. Why? Such foolishness. Sober-minded, chaste, pure. There are, the way people dress, if you went down in the summer to the mall and scooped up a bunch of girls and put them in a time machine and took them back in time a few decades and let them out on a street corner, the Vice Squad would pick them up pretty quick. A friend of mine went to, he was looking for some clothes for some outfits for his daughters, and he went to the mall and he was looking around, and I thought this made a pretty good point. There was just nothing fitting, so he just walked over to the sales clerk. He said, excuse me, he said, do you have anything other than prostitute clothing? And I thought, you know, that's really what it is. That's what it was. It's ridiculous. And you can even see the little bitty outfits for the little bitty girls. Just trashy, suggestive-looking stuff. I don't know what parents are thinking. There's a few moms out there that are taking vicarious thrill and living through their daughters, living out their glory days of high school promiscuity. That's what's going on sometimes. You know how, you ever been to the Little League game, and here's some boys out there trying to play baseball, and there's the one father that's just a jerk and ruining it for everybody, because maybe back in high school, he enjoyed playing baseball, and he was going to be, you know, a pro baseball player, and he was going to, and of course, he wasn't. And so he's just been disappointed, and then one day his wife said, we have a baby boy! And ching! You know, okay, here's my second chance. And he's trying to live through his son. There's some women that have been doing that. And that they glory in their daughters acting seductively and stuff. Others I don't know. Some parents, you wonder if they're just naive. Sober-minded. Pure. And look at the next one. Workers at home. I want you to think about that and compare it to our culture today. There's not a problem. It's biblical for a woman to make money. Let's pull this off here and look down the list further and come back up to that point. But in Proverbs 31, remember the worthy woman? The worthy woman who can find? Her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband trusts in her. She does him good and not evil. She stretches out her hand to the needy. She looks well to the ways of her household. Strength and dignity are her clothing. Law of kindness is on her tongue. We'll talk a little bit about that more in a minute. But did she make money? Yes, she did. You remember? She made garments. And then she went to town and sold them to the merchants. She also considered a field and bought it. So was she, you know, involved in some financial deals and doing some work and making money that helps the family? Yes. Is there anything wrong with that? No. It's quite biblical right there in Proverbs 31. But when you read about that woman in Proverbs 31, does it strike you that she is a woman centered on her family or a woman centered on her career? It's a woman centered on her family. Our society, since around 1970 or so, has adopted almost wholesale the concept that the man should work full time, the woman should work full time, and find something to do with the kids. What does Titus say? Women, older women, are to train the younger women to love their husbands, love their children, and be workers at home. Daycare is, I was reading, I didn't know, I knew I was going to be dealing with this point in Titus 2, but I was reading, I picked up at the library the night before my flight out here, a book that just looked interesting to read on the plane, and I had no idea it was going to deal with this subject, but it did. It's by a journalist named Harry Stein, and he started off as a kind of a hippies activist. His parents had been, you know, communist party members, you know, years before and such. And he kind of chronicles his mind shift. And he says it started when his wife had a baby. She was, you know, that kind of mentality too. But when she had a baby, she said she quit her job. She was going to stay home with the baby. And he thought that was nuts. But then later, he started spending time with that baby and finding out that it's enjoyable to spend time with that baby. And that baby became important to them. And then he was asked to, Esquire magazine was going to have a special, an upcoming special on women. And so he was going to do an article. And he did his article on daycare. I've got some friends who run a daycare. And I talked to, sometime back in South Carolina, I was talking to a woman that ran a daycare. And there's some ugly things going on with daycare. And a lot of research has shown as well that when people have a child and they just turn it over to, Reader's Digest had an article about this some years ago, Hard Truths About Daycare. And it concluded with pointing out that a child simply doesn't get the same thing from somebody that does only for money what most of us only do for love. And it talked about, it gave statistics and different things about the children having more trouble at school, being more violent, having more social problems, et cetera, et cetera. And then even the New York Times, just a few years ago, had an article that even in high-quality daycare, there's still problems. And they don't do as well as when they're with the parents. God gave us children, and he gave us a lot of time with children. This fellow, when he writes, let me tell you a couple of scenarios, in fact, just to illustrate one type of thing that's going on. The lady in South Carolina I talked to that ran a daycare, she said she was trying to run a good one, relatively speaking, She said she used to work at another one, and she said this was her job, one of her jobs, to color pictures with an unsteady hand that would look like a child did it. Because at the end of the day, when career mom and career dad come and pick up their little bundle of joy that they're not... In Britain, you know how much time most fathers are spending with their children a day? Somewhere around like 10 minutes a day. I forget, it's either 15 or 5 minutes a day, one of those two. So it's about 10
a day.
While back, somebody invented a device that would float in the tub and had place for your bowl of SpaghettiOs and a book, so that you could, because everybody knows what your child need. They need a bath and supper and a bedtime story. And we sure don't want to have time after doing everything in life about our own interests to have to spend much time doing it. And so this way, you can put them in the tub. Yeah, okay, put the floaty in there. Okay, have her bite. And then little Red Riding Hood. Okay, open up here. Let me get behind your ears. 15 minutes, you're done. So her job was to color pictures because they want parents to think, oh, look, your child's been coloring pictures today. No, it wasn't. They were paying staff to do that. It may have been when she quit, when they told her one of them had gotten mad at one of the kids and hit them and bruised them. And they said, you stay, and when the parents come, you say that he fell off the slide. In Pennsylvania, just recently, a couple that runs a daycare, small one, and I'm going to be, I don't want to gross everybody out, and I don't want to be too graphic, but a six-year-old did something with a three-year-old that never, ever, ever would have occurred just normally between a six-year-old and a three-year-old. Where do they learn something like that? There's so many people perverted out there. The six-year-old would come from a family, I don't know if this is where from or somewhere else, but had just recently been babysat by a couple of teenagers who come from a family where the parents have relations in front of their teenage children. Whatever the case is, in other words, there's enough perversion out there that anytime you've got 30 kids together in a room, there's a high likelihood that some of those kids have already been molested or exposed to some pretty perverse things. And if you've got a couple of people being paid a little bit more than minimum wage watching them all day, are they going to be able to protect? Because a lot of those sexual things go from older predators looking for younger, and then that younger one looking for younger, and the younger on down like that. Well, they talked to their licensing board, the company that licensed them, about what had happened. You know what the licensing board said? They said, you keep it quiet. Do you think that's the first time that licensing company had told that to one of their daycares? When he does this article, when Harry Stein does this article, he said, call it naive, I truly believe the thoughtful, probing piece on daycare would elicit a positive response, even among readers not necessarily happy with the message. He says it was actually pretty mild, but he said, let's see, to one thing, one journalist friend asked him to spend a couple of days at a fancy-schmancy daycare center where his 18-month-old daughter was a student, reportedly one of the best facilities in the city. So, okay, so he's going to go and spend a couple of days at this real high-dollar one, you know, where they're, you know, supposed to get you so far ahead academically and everything. So he did. One thing, after a couple of days at the pricey daycare place, I noted that the pair of young Hispanic women discharged with caring for the very youngest kids were clearly overwhelmed. Yet in interactions with the kids' mothers, both sides tended to adopt a policy of don't ask, don't tell. I watched one four-month-old new arrival at the facility cry bloody murder for most of an afternoon. Yet when his power-suited young executive mom breezed into the place a little past six, he was asleep. Beaming, she exclaimed he'd never looked so happy, and no one told her the truth. This lady down in South Carolina, I think she was telling me about babies just left banging their heads and screaming for hours and hours and hours. That's not what kids need. Then, too, one of the experts I quoted was the renowned child psychologist Lee Salk, who had this to say. I love dogs, but I'd never keep one in a New York apartment because it's not fair to the dog. I think parents who are unwilling to give their children the attention they need should consider not having any. Turned out he'd had problems with daycare all along, but no reporter had ever questioned him about it. Still, most of the other experts, even those with serious reservations, were pretty much mealy-mouthed. In fact, the most eminent of them all, Dr. Spock, forbade me to quote him at all, saying off the record, though, he did have serious doubts about daycare. He wasn't ready to publicly air them. Kids need parents. That's what they need. God gave parents kids. There was an experiment, horrible experiment, done in Russia some years ago that some of you may have heard of. They took some babies and they made sure that they had shelter and food, but nothing else. Nobody cuddled them. Nobody sang to them. Nobody touched them. Some of the babies just died. And for the ones that lived, can you imagine the difficulty of not having any bonding, what that could produce? Babies need time. And children need time. A friend of mine was asked to go and talk with a couple who were having family troubles. They had maybe teenagers and mom and dad, and they just went over, and they had some nice stuff, maybe a boat and some nice belongings, big screen TV or whatever, I don't know what all. The family was stressed. Things weren't going well. The relationships weren't going that well with the kids, I guess, and between the husband and wife, they didn't have time for each other, and they just weren't. And as they would go, they said, well, we get home from work, and we're just tired and exhausted, and this and this and this and this. And he finally suggested, well, it sounds like a lot of your troubles come from you're both working so much that you don't have time for the family. Maybe you should consider doing something different. And you know what they said? What? And give up all this? What's more important, the house or the home? There's nothing wrong with a woman making money. A worthy woman made money. She considered a field and bought it. She made garments. She took them to the merchants, sold them, brought in profit. Nothing wrong with that. But what was the primary job of a mother? If you can do something on the side that brings in some money, okay, but don't let the mothering be the thing that's on the side. Love their husbands. Love their children. Be workers at home. Rule the household. 1 Timothy 5, oikos despota. It's the despot of the house. Fellas, we need to realize that the wife needs, you don't want your wife going out to the garage or the tool room and saying, ooh, those screwdrivers don't look good there. Let's, you know, well, don't go, you know, controlling her kitchen and such. You know, as she's managing affairs in the house, you're the head of the house overall, but in the things that she's doing, let her manage that house. Let her rule the household, as it says in 1 Timothy 5. That's not authority over the husband, but it's don't micromanage your wife to death. 1 Timothy chapter 5. Younger widows, the advice here is given to, in verse 14, I desire therefore that younger women marry, bear children. Some translations will say something like manage the household. The American Standard says rule the household. In Greek, the word is, you know, house despot, basically. So ruling the household, and do it well. Proverbs 31, that woman did it well, didn't she? Her work far above rubies. The heart of her husband trusts in her. That's an important thing. That's an important thing for love. It's an important thing for security. It's an important thing for romance. For there to be trust between the husband and the wife. Husband, make sure your wife can trust you. Wife, make sure that your husband trusts you. She does him good and not evil. all the days of his life. She stretches out her hand to the needy. She made money, but she also helped other people, which is what Ephesians tells us to do. It says, stop stealing and work so that you can help people who are in need. She looks ways and well way of her household. Remember, her house was clothed in scarlet, you know, and they were ready for the snow in the winter. She took care of her family. Strength and dignity of her clothing. And the law of kindness is on her tongue. Let's stop and think about that for a minute. I don't know if anybody here in particular needs this, but usually there's a few people and that need some reminder about it. We mentioned the idea of nagging at the beginning. I just want you to think. When, and maybe we can illustrate it with these right here. Moms, do you ever have one of those days where just everything is going wrong? One of the kids didn't do the job that they were supposed to do. You know, you thought you had all the bills paid, and now you just found, here's a statement, you missed one, now there's a late penalty on that. The muffler fell off of the car. You know, your husband was supposed to bring home the beef from the butcher shop, and he forgot to, again. And just everything's going, and just about that time, somebody called on the phone, you picked up the baby, and then, you know, and just, it's just one of those days. We get upset on those kind of days. How do we speak? When you're under pressure, when you get frustrated and tense, I've worked with one mom, one of her biggest problems is just getting tense. When you get frustrated and your tension rises, if we'll graph this out, okay, if that's tension, like at the beginning of the day, it's okay, you got your cup of coffee, things start, first problem, kind of annoying, another one. And then later by the day, it's just tension mounts and mounts and mounts, and you get frustrated. What happens to your effectiveness? Exactly right. The other way, isn't it? The effectiveness just goes down. And does it spread to the rest of the family? There's an old expression, when mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. You know, and it goes around and around. Of course, husbands can bring that as well. You know, you can have a husband who, you know, he's been with his boss, maybe got chewed out by the plant manager because the plant manager had something go wrong in his life, so he chewed out the boss unfairly. Then the boss is mad. And so then, you know, he lets dad have it. And he just really loads on him. And you're going to have this project done by next week. And criticizes him for things he didn't do wrong. And it's all unfair, but just unloads on him. Now the fellas blamed for stuff he didn't do. Wasn't his fault. He told them last week they ought to do it a different way. They said do it this way. Now everything's bad. So now he's mad and he's frustrated. And he's got all this stuff. He comes home. He starts jumping on the wife and fussing at her because, you know, he didn't want, you know, peas again, and they had peas last week. Then she gets irritated. She's mad at him. She's had a bad day. And so then the kids start squabbling with each other, and then they start picking on the little brother, and they start picking on the little sister. And, you know, somebody finally gets down to the dog. Somebody's kicking the dog, you know, or the cat. That stuff gets contagious. Don't let that happen. The worthy woman puts on her tongue the law of kindness. One mom I was dealing with has one child that she just really clashes with. And I've heard her tone of voice, and I've seen different things that have been problematic in the situation. And he's a good boy in lots of ways, but he still clashes with his mom a lot. But she just gets tense with him. She just gets up. Well, what do you think happens when she gets tense with him? It makes him tense and angry. And one time we just went through this, and I just sat there, and she finally said, so you're saying it's my fault? I said, yes. I said, you need to start being calm. And when you discipline him, be firm. Have a smile on your face. You know, let him know. Say, all right, here's what's going to happen. You know, like, you can either do this right now without an attitude, or I'm going to spank you and send you to bed right now without supper. It's your choice. You know, I'm suggesting you choose the first one, but you can choose. Guess which he's going to choose? The first one. You can have a smile on your face. When you're suspended, what happens? It doesn't make things better. Makes everybody more tense and such. So moms and dads and everybody else, let's have a law of kindness on the tongue. Sometimes there's going to be pressure. Sometimes the tire's going to blow out. Sometimes the water heater's, you know, going to spring a leak or something. But if we can remember to be kind, it's going to make a world of difference. Are you a thermometer? Oh, and a hint here to husbands. If it's true that when mom ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And with fellas, is that pretty much true? Are things happy around your house when mom ain't happy? When Bertina's not happy, ours is not a happy place. Does mom sometimes have an awful lot on her plate? I know my wife does. We've got six kids. We've still got five at home. And she does a lot of stuff. In fact, she homeschools them, so she's really, really pretty busy. You know what we need to do, fellas, is sometimes realize that sometimes mom's had a really rough day and say, hey, let me take the baby, you know, for a couple of hours. You know, if you still got a baby in the house, it's a load. You know, it's sometimes nice to have a break. So if we come home and we just pop down and we're going to just watch the game and that's it, if mom's had a rough day, what can we do? Help relieve some of that pressure by saying, hey, let me bring some, don't worry about cooking tonight, I'll bring some pizzas. Or let me take the kids, you know, tomorrow, I'm just going to take them to the park and you can have some time to yourself. You know, Bertina loves to have time to herself just so she can get something done on the house instead of with the kids. But other times, just to relax or read a book or go exercise or something. So, fellas, it pays to help mom have some of that stress gone on those days when things are tough to do something for her that makes it easier. Now, are you a thermometer or a thermostat? What does a thermometer do when it gets hotter in the room? It goes up. If it gets hotter still, it does what? It goes up. What does a thermostat do? A thermostat is connected to your heating or cooling system so that if when it starts to get hot, it makes the air conditioner kick on and cools things off. If it's starting to get too cold, it kicks the heater on, warms things back up to a comfortable temperature. Some people are thermometers. Some people are thermostats. Some people are okay until something else is going wrong. And if other things are heating up, then they are then. Some people are thermostats. If things aren't as warm as they need to be, they know what to do to warm things up. If things are getting too hot, they cool it down by their demeanor and by the way they speak. What are you? I know sometimes I'm a thermometer. Sometimes. Sometimes I can be a thermostat. What are you? Let's aim to be better at being thermostats and have a law of kindness on our tongues like that worthy woman. Lastly, God-centered homes. Look at Deuteronomy 6. We'll be talking about this passage again tomorrow. 4 through 9. The first verse, this is the text Jesus quoted when the scribe asked him, what is the greatest commandment in the law? Jesus didn't go to the Ten Commandments. He went to Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. Jesus went on and added to it from Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself. He said all the rest of it hangs on those two things. Because that covers our vertical relationship with God who is greater than us, and our horizontal relationship with other people who would love as ourselves. But then he goes on and he says what? These statutes that I give you this day, let me read there. Deuteronomy 6, verse 6. These words which I am commanding to you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and talk of them when you sit in your house. When else? When you walk by the way. When else? When you lie down. When else? When you rise up. Verse 9, you shall write them on doorposts of your house and on your gates. You know the old expression, the family that prays together stays together? There's some truth in that. Now, if all you do is have a prayer over a meal, that's not going to do it. But it's important and valuable for a family to have time together focusing on God's Word. Time together in the evening or in the morning to sit down and sing a few songs together. Or to go around and ask the kids some Bible questions, or let them ask some Bible questions and answer them. Or to do some Bible reading and say, you know, this month we're going to go through the book of Proverbs or something, or work our way through the songbook or something like that. Time spent, and it doesn't have to be a long, long time, but time spent in the family, that's so, so, so valuable. There's so many things competing for attention. And if you wait until if you don't have any of that focus in the home, and you wait until the kids are, you know, wearing death metal t-shirts and, hanging out with horrible looking people with metal hanging out of their face and such, and say, oh, I think we need to start having some Bible study in the home, they're probably not interested in that at that point. Start it before that kind of problem and have Bible focus in the home. Have a God-centered home. And not just the time when the whole family sits down like that, but what did it say? When you rise up, when you lie down, when you walk away? Just when there's opportunities in life. As you're driving down the road maybe and you see something, point out, oh, look at that. And you know, either something beautiful in God's creation or somebody misbehaving in public and talking about that and saying, look at that. Isn't that sad that some people can behave like that? And help them to understand, or a police car hauling somebody to jail, and talk about, you know, why some people live like that and how foolish it is. Just whenever you have an opportunity, help them understand those things. There's a lot of things competing for our attention, but within our families, we need to have a spiritual focus. Thank you for your attention this evening. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about kids. We're going to be talking about parenting and child training, especially, and then also some instruction for the younger people from Scripture and stuff. If you're subject to the invitation tonight, won't you come and stand and sing?